Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Battle of King's Mountain, Eyewitness Accounts, The Battle That Turned the Tide of the American Revolution, by Robert M. Dunkerley, narrated by Tom Beyer. Notice, the information in this book is true and complete to the best of our knowledge. It is offered without guarantee on the part of the author or the History Press. The author and the History Press disclaim all liability in connection with the use of this book. Introduction. On October 7, 1780, a severe battle raged on the steep, craggy hillsides at Kings Mountain, South Carolina. Two armies that had been marching for weeks finally came to grips here on this isolated ridge. The battle was unique for several reasons. It pitted Americans against each other, as rebels fought loyalists, and it marked the high tide of British occupation of the state. Surprisingly, while many historians consider the battle a turning point, there has been no effort to collect and examine eyewitness accounts from the battle. This book fills that need. While Lyman C. Draper's massive King's Mountain and Its Heroes will always be the classic epic history of the battle, there are accounts to which Draper did not have access, chose not to use, used in part, or edited from the original form. It is hoped that this work will further interest in the King's Mountain campaign and be an aid to researchers. Details of the accounts were preserved to capture the flavor of the originals. This allows us to hear the writings as the veterans told their stories, using their writing and speaking style and their expressions. This collection includes only actual accounts and pension statements by eyewitnesses or contemporaries. The various conversations and statements found in Draper's book were not included, since these were often only fragments, and without the whole dialogue, they are of little value. Many of Draper's sources were stories passed on by children, grandchildren, or others who heard them from veterans. Only accounts written by the participants themselves are included here. After the war, a controversy arose over American commander Colonel William Campbell's actions in the battle. Several officers accused him of staying back during the fighting. Campbell, dead since 1781, could not defend himself, but several relatives and men who served with him did. A series of letters were exchanged discussing Campbell's role in the battle, and only those with specific battle details are included. Draper included many of these statements at the end of his book, yet he edited them to fit his stylistic needs. They are reproduced here, in their original form, in the Shelby Campbell controversy section. A reference like this is needed to get to the true story. Many books about King's Mountain quote participants or retell their stories, but this work is intended to present the men in their own words, with no filter. The Battle of King's Mountain lasted approximately 1 hour. Yet for those who were there, it was no doubt the most exciting hour of their lives. Many King's Mountain veterans lived into their 90s or beyond. Some died in the 1830s, 1840s, or even 1850s. The oldest survivor, Robert Henry of North Carolina, died in 1863 at age 98. The longest living veteran was John Hammond, who lived until 1868, 3 years after the close of the Civil War. This is a story of memories. Most of these men were in their 70s, 80s, or 90s when they filed pension applications. Some memories are clouded, others are incredibly vivid. These men, Americans all, experienced things they would never totally forget at King's Mountain. It is these stories, uncorrupted by historians, presented in their original form, that can speak directly to us. In the heat of battle, did time slow down or stop? Did it speed up? Time is often either compressed or expanded for combat veterans. Few soldiers could see the larger picture. Most rarely knew their own unit's role in the battle, much less the overall situation. When the bullets began to fly, most focused on their own actions, loading and firing, finding cover and advancing. The accounts must also be examined carefully, since many contain contradictory information. How do we reconcile two versions of the same event, like the deaths of Colonel James Williams and Major Patrick Ferguson, for example? Colonel Samuel Newell, who in his accounts wrote often that, "I do not recollect, I believe," and "I'm not certain." He tells us of the stress that he was under, writing, "I had been nearly 36 hours without any kind of refreshments, and marched under an almost constant torrent of rain. I had lost, by my wound, as much blood perhaps as anyone could and retain life, and my wound was then extremely painful." Decades removed from the fact, how could details not become confused? Private William Moore wrote how he acted during combat, explaining, "I had neither time nor inclination to be looking around during the action, except keeping my eyes upon the enemy, and occasionally seeing my own officers as they passed along. Going through the motions, loading, firing, and watching the enemy shooting at him, took all his concentration during the battle." Modern listeners should also know that both sides referred to their own militias, which may be confusing. While the Americans had a militia system in place, the British established one in South Carolina in the summer of 1780. Major Patrick Ferguson organized 7 Loyalist militia regiments at 96, and parts of those regiments fought at King's Mountain. Hearing the accounts will make one point very apparent. The nature of militia service meant that families served together. These accounts mention fathers and sons, brothers, uncles and cousins serving together, or in some cases, on opposite sides. A surprisingly large number of the Whigs not only survived the battle and the war, but also went on to file pensions. About 910 Americans fought in the battle. Roughly 27 were killed that day, and another 3 were mortally wounded, giving a total loss of 30. 15 more died before the close of the war, either in other battles or of natural causes, including the commander, Colonel William Campbell. Out of the 910 combatants, 45 died by the end of the war. The majority of those survivors filed pensions or statements about their service. According to Dr. Bobby Moss's research, 664 federal pensions were filed for service at King's Mountain, an incredibly large percentage. This has truly been a blessing, as these are often an invaluable source of information. Most pension applications merely state a soldier was at King's Mountain, but a few contained amazing details of the battle. Federal pensions are an important source in researching the Revolution. The Continental Congress first authorized pensions in 1776, half pay for life, for officers and men disabled in service. Gradually during the war, compensation was expanded for anyone who served, regardless of rank, term of service, or injury. Widows and orphans became eligible for pensions by the close of the conflict as well. In 1818, Congress offered the first remuneration for veterans that was truly compensation, not aimed at recruiting to fill the ranks. It was available to men who had served and were in need of financial assistance. A more groundbreaking measure and one of immense benefit to historians, came in 1832 when Congress granted pensions to all Revolutionary War veterans and spouses, regardless of financial status. Veterans had to appear in court with witnesses and provide details of their service. Widows and children were also eligible. These pension applications are often straightforward, but some include a wealth of information on battles and leaders. Loyalists' voices are hard to find. Loyalist pension records and muster rolls contain few details other than dates of service, commanders, and locations. Draper's manuscripts contain only fragments on the Loyalists, mostly letters written by descendants or neighbors who recounted stories they had heard. Robinson Delancey, a Canadian writing to Draper in 1881, lamented, "We are trying to establish a historical and genealogical museum in this province to save, as far as possible, the memory of its early families from a most undeserved oblivion, but from the vandalism of their descendants, losing and destroying early documents and records, we have come to the conclusion that we started just 20 years too late." Unlike the victorious Americans, few Loyalists wrote, spoke of, or commemorated their deeds, especially concerning a defeat like King's Mountain. It is not surprising, as many Loyalists, who were refugees after the war, merely wanted to start over and get their affairs in order. Draper did correspond with many descendants of Loyalists, both in the Carolinas and in the Atlantic provinces of Canada, but these are secondary stories as they are retellings of what a relative said rather than a primary source. The voices of women are unfortunately also largely silent. Several women were in the Battle of King's Mountain, and one made it even possible. Mary Patton of modern-day Tennessee made most of the gunpowder used by the American forces. Gunpowder was a valuable and precious commodity on the frontier, and her contribution was invaluable. On the Loyalist side, Ferguson had two female servants with him in the battle, Virginia Sal and Virginia Paul. Sal was killed in the battle and is buried with Ferguson on the battlefield. Recent archaeology confirms this. Accounts mention that several women were held as prisoners by the Loyalist forces and were liberated at the close of the fighting. Ferguson's army had taken several prisoners in the weeks before the battle as they moved through western North Carolina. Many local women also came to nurse the wounded and look for relatives. One woman even rode by herself from Virginia to find her wounded husband. None of these women wrote about their experiences at King's Mountain, or at least so far none have been located, but several of the documents that follow mention these women. Together, these accounts shed light on many overlooked aspects of the campaign, such as the fate of prisoners, participants switching sides, and the battle's dramatic close. These stories give a more complete picture of the complex King's Mountain story. Often, accounts were illegible due to the poor preservation of documents, faded ink, or difficulty in reading handwriting, so words that could not be made out will be read as illegible. American Accounts. Proof of the Spirit and Resources of the Country. General George Washington, American Commander-in-Chief, on the News of King's Mountain. William Alexander's Pension Application. Entered the service as a volunteer under the command of Captain David Beatty. He does not now recollect who was the lieutenant, but is under the impression his name was Robert Edmondson, and Major Nathaniel Dryden was killed in the Battle of King's Mountain. Colonel William Campbell commanded the regiment. Colonel John Sevier and Colonel Isaac Shelby was along. We marched by way of Holston and Watauga Rivers, Yellow Mountain, Green River, Broad River, at the Cherokee Ford, and within about 4 days' march of King's Mountain, when the mountain troops were ordered to go on ahead of the foot troops, who were to follow. But after marching a day or two, we met the troops, illegible. The Battle of King's Mountain having been fought, the troops then marched to the island Ford on Catawba River, where the mounted men were directed to escort the prisoners taken in the Battle of King's Mountain to Salisbury in North Carolina, and the footmen returned home. Alexander was a soldier who was on the march. He did not fight in the battle, and later guarded the prisoners. Richard Allen's account. After the troops were organized, they all set out on their march to meet Major Ferguson. Upon the way, they were joined by Colonel Campbell and a body of troops from Virginia, as also by Colonel Sevier, Shelby, and McDowell, with troops from North Carolina after a illegible of the troops formed, and most of them had horses. It was proposed that all of those who had horses or could procure them should advance immediately upon Ferguson. This illegible had a horse and was anxious to proceed on to the main army, but a great many were on foot and would necessarily be let behind. It became necessary that the charge of those should be committed to some officer. Offered to Colonel Joseph Herndon, but he positively refused to accept it unless this illegible, who he said had more experience than him, should be detained to stay with him. In that state of affairs, Colonel Cleveland thought proper to order this illegible to remain in charge of the footmen, and he accordingly did so. They continued their march, however, with all possible speed in the direction of King's Mountain, but were not able to reach it in time to engage in the battle, it having been fought, and the Americans with their prisoners being on their return some short distance before they met with them. When they rejoined the army, they continued with them and assisted in guarding the prisoners until they proceeded as far as the Moravian towns in the county of Stokes, and after remaining there a considerable time, they were relieved by Colonel Winston with a detachment of foot troops, and Colonel Cleveland and his men returned home, which place they reached sometime in November, the precise time not recollected, but they were in service in this illegible about 2 months. Allen was one of those left at Cowpens while the army moved on to King's Mountain. Martin Armstrong's letter to General Horatio Gates. Surrey County, November 7, 1780. Sir, the first instant I relieved the guards at this place, the 4th received your orders of the 31st October. Enclosed, you will have a report of the prisoners delivered me by Colonel Cleveland, out of which number 188 are the inhabitants of Salisbury District, and are taken out of my hands by the civil power, and bound over to your law. Last night, 3 British lieutenants on parole made their escape, to wit, William Stevenson, Anthony Allaire, and John Taylor, and one Guest, a South Carolina Tory captain. The enclosed letter from Captain De Peyster was wrote before the above circumstance of the escape happened, but I have reason to confide in these officers present, as they show every mark of uneasiness for the ungentlemanly conduct of those absent. I have the honor to be your most obedient and most humble servant, Major General Gates. P.S. Since I wrote the above, 16 soldiers made their escape from the guard. Captain De Peyster has now helped his word for the remainder. The Tory prisoners have all enlisted into the Continental Service, except in a small number which the justices have committed to Halifax, there being but a few of the British. I am solicited by the officers from Virginia not to send them over the mountains until your pleasure is further known. I am, sir, yours, Martin Armstrong. Though he was not in the battle, Armstrong's letter contains important information about the prisoners. He writes of the escape of several. The guest he mentions is William Gist, which is chronicled in the diary of Anthony Allaire. In all, nearly 300 prisoners escaped to reach the British fort at 96. Jacob Beeler's statement. That Colonel McDowell crossed over from the state of North Carolina, where Pemberton's company joined him, and marched across the Yellow Mountain to the aforesaid King's Mountain, where they met Ferguson's army in the aforesaid mountain, but before the march of the men. Shelby, Campbell, Sevier, and Cleveland all had joined McDowell's men. Colonel Campbell had the principal command at the Battle of King's Mountain, which, illegible, in the death of Ferguson and the total defeat to capture of his army, except those who might have run before the mountain had been surrounded by the American troops. That after the, illegible, marched the prisoners to Salisbury and delivered them to the militia there, these being about 800 in number, which service for 3 months, and was discharged by Colonel Shelby. Beeler from eastern Tennessee fought here with his brother Joseph. The musket he used is currently in the museum at Kings Mountain National Military Park. Statement of James Blair. Joined Captain Barton with General Cleveland on their way to King's Mountain, and was in that battle. Afterwards, one of the guards to the prisoners taken to Moravian Town, where he was discharged. Blair, from Burke County, North Carolina, was 19 at the time of the battle. He also fought at Blackstocks, Ramsar's Mill, Fishing Creek, and Augusta. Henry Blevins' pension application. Marched under the command of Colonel Isaac Shelby to King's Mountain, and was joined at the Yellow Mountain in North Carolina by the regiment under the command of Colonel Sevier and Colonel Campbell, and arrived at King's Mountain on or about the 7th day of October, 1780, when the army came up with Colonel Ferguson, and at the time said battle was fought, this declarant was detailed as one of the guard to guard the baggage, this belonging to the American troops, and was not in the engagement. This declarant further states that he was marched from King's Mountain to Salem in North Carolina with the prisoners. From thence returned home after serving about 5 months. Blevins fought on the North Carolina and Virginia frontier under Shelby and Sevier. He died in Tennessee in 1847. Charles Bowen's pension application. That he entered the service of the United States during the Revolutionary War and served as follows. The particular times he is unable to say, but knows that he served under the command of Captain Bowen, a brother of declarant, under the command of Captain John Campbell, and was in the Battle of King's Mountain under the command of Captain William Edmondson, who was there killed. That his brother, Reese Bowen, was also a captain in the service at the time, and was likewise killed in the Battle of King's Mountain. In this battle, Colonel William Campbell commanded, and Colonel Cleveland also was a commander. During this action, by some means, declarant obtained information that Reese Bowen, his brother, was killed, and being much distressed, and illegible, proceeded in search of his brother, hoping that he was only wounded. In his search for his brother, he discovered his captain, William Edmondson, dead or dying, having been shot in the head. Declarant advanced without being sensible of his danger till within 15 or 20 paces of the enemy. Declarant slipped behind a tree, cocked his gun, and shot the first man who hoisted the flag among the enemy, and immediately turned his back to the tree to reload his gun, when Colonel Cleveland advanced, called on declarant for the countersign, which declarant could not immediately recollect, nor could he give it. Colonel Cleveland instantly leveled his rifle at declarant's breast and attempted to fire, but the gun snapped. Declarant jumped at Cleveland, seized him by the collar, took his tomahawk, and would have sunk it in Cleveland's head if his arm had not been arrested by a soldier by the name of Buchanan, and who knew the parties. Declarant immediately recollected the countersign, which was Buford, illegible, and Cleveland dropped his gun and clasped declarant in his arms. The persons who hoisted the flag were twice shot, besides the time this declarant shot, but by whom he knows not. The applicant secured a discharge from Colonel William Campbell. This statement shows the power and limits of memory. Bowen admits he is unable to give particulars of his service, but describes in great detail the battle. The death of his brother and the incident with Colonel Cleveland left him with enduring memories. Draper used this in his book. William Bradley's pension application. He was wounded in the Battle of King's Mountain in the right arm, and never afterwards was able to return to the service. Bradley, who lived near the battlefield at the mouth of Buffalo Creek, was severely wounded in the battle. Ensign Robert Campbell's account. Captain De Peyster raised a flag and called for quarters. He was soon taken out of his hand by one of the mounted officers on horseback and raised so high that it could be seen by our line. Brother of the commander, Robert Campbell eventually rose to the rank of colonel. He later served as magistrate for Washington County, Virginia, for many years. He eventually settled in Tennessee. Robert Campbell wrote several other accounts of the battle, which are included next. Ensign Robert Campbell's account. In the fall of the year 1780, when the American cause wore a very gloomy aspect in the southern states, Colonels Arthur and William Campbell, hearing of the advance of Colonel Ferguson along the mountains in the state of North Carolina, and that the Whigs were retreating before him, unable to make any effectual resistance, formed a plan to intercept him, and communicated it to the commanding officers of Sullivan and Washington counties in the state of North Carolina. They readily agreed to cooperate in any expedition against Colonel Ferguson. Colonel Arthur Campbell immediately ordered the militia of Washington County, Virginia, amounting to near 400, to make ready to march under command of Colonel William Campbell, who was known to be an enterprising and active officer. Colonels Shelby and Sevier raised a party of 300, joined him on his march, and moved with forced marches toward Colonel Ferguson. At the same time, Colonels Williams, Cleveland, Tracy, and Brannan of the states of North and South Carolina each conducted a small party toward the same point, amounting to near 300. Colonel Ferguson had notice of their approach by a deserter that left the army on the Yellow Mountain, and immediately commenced his march for Charlotte, dispatching at the same time different messengers to Lord Cornwallis with information of his danger. These messengers being intercepted on their way, no movement was made to favor his retreat. These several corps of American volunteers, amounting to near 1,000 men, met at Gilberttown, and the officers unanimously chose Colonel Campbell to the command. About 700 choice riflemen mounted their horses for the purpose of following the retreating army. The balance, being chiefly footmen, were left to follow on and come up as soon as they could. The pursuit was too rapid to render an escape practicable.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?